Hello. I hope that people are slowly returning from lunch. Don't know what the situation in the room is currently. I hope you can all hear me. Those online perhaps can give me another indication that you're there with a thumbs up, something in the chat, just to know how many people are back already and if we're ready for the next session. Perfect. Thank you, Vanessa, Maria, Anna, everyone who's indicated something.
Thank you, Nora. I think we're about to start our afternoon sessions. I'll let Edward introduce Wolfgang. Thank you.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. And now we come indeed to the last quarter of the event, and it's time to move to look out to the rest of the world. And I'm very glad to be joined by my colleague from Maastricht, Wolfgang Kurt, who, among other things, has been involved in the exercise of external action, he may mention it, in the past, and is now working with us, among other things, focusing on these issues. And I'm going to pass to him to cover external action and the CFSP, CSDP world. And over to you. Thank you, Wolfgang.
Thank you very much, Edward. And hello to everyone, ladies and gentlemen. Now, it's a big pleasure for me to be here in this gorgeous environment and have the opportunity to deliver this briefing on the EU external action. As Edward indicated, the first hour or so will be more in general about EU external action, and then we go after a coffee break more into detail into CFSP and CSDP. So, ladies and gentlemen, external action is a term that, after a decade, we have got used to slowly. I remind you that this term has been introduced to our vocabulary, to our dictionary, with the Lisbon Treaty in 2009. And, well, at the beginning, I remember that felt a little bit strange, this term, external action. Yes, what is it exactly? Why? And why don't we just call it foreign policy? There were some member states that thought that this was not a very good idea, because foreign policy is something that states have, and the EU certainly, for some member states, it should be made very clear that the EU was not a state, so no foreign policy. We use external action. As we do not have a constitution, we have the fundamental treaties. Instead of EU laws, we talk about regulations and directives, so to make sure that the EU is really not a state but something else. So, proposed we look very briefly at the objectives and definitions, then we look, scan the policies and the actors, and then we go to the agenda of the Portuguese presidency, or I'd rather say the potential agenda, because more than anything else, external relations, foreign policy is events-driven, so it's sometimes quite hard to plan a long time ahead. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you know that the EU has the ambition to be a global player, to be an authoritative actor on the global scene. Now, an actor that does not only react to events that happen somewhere in the world, but that also proactively shapes the agenda and shapes the way in which the direction in which the world goes. So for that, of course, the first thing to have is to be clear about your objectives. What are the objectives of the EU? What do we want in our external action? Now, This being the EU, the best advice is to go open the treaties, look into the treaties and what they say. And that's what I propose we'll do. We go into the TEU, the Treaty on European Union, Article 3.5, where we find the objectives of EU external action. And here, basically, the main phrase is the EU shall uphold and promote its values and interests and contribute to the protection of its citizens. Now, you know that there is quite a debate about these values and interests. I mean, are values and interests the same? Do they go into the both directions? Are they compatible or contradictory sometimes? Now, if you read further this article, you have a long list of examples what we mean, what the EU means by these values and interests. And if you go through this, peace, security, sustainable development, solidarity, mutual respect among the peoples, I would say you find a lot of values, not so much interest. So the question is really, I mean, is it really what we want in external action to make a world a better place? Not much else. Well, I have to say, in 2016, the global strategy in 2016 gave some additional guidance because the global strategy was seen as sort of resetting the balance between values and interests and suggesting that the EU should maybe focus more on interest, on the interests of its citizens, and not only on, let's say, these idealistic aspirations to make the world a better place. I quote from the global strategy, you know, that our external policies should be driven by a realistic assessment of the strategic environment as much as the idealistic aspiration to advance a better world. So, in other words, we also have to care about the interest of our citizens, first and foremost. So, now going back to this term external action, when this term serves as sort of a blanket term to designate all the different policies and policy instruments the EU has at its proposal to conducting and shaping its relations with the rest of the world. Now, there is one dimension where the EU has exclusive competence, a full transfer of competences from the member states to the EU. That's the trade policy or common commercial policy, so the most integrated one. Then, in most cases, we have shared and parallel competences. This is when we talk about development, humanitarian aid, but also migration, which since a few years is considered a fully-fledged external policy, whereas before it was rather considered an internal policy, now it's also fully-fledged external policy. And here in this shared competence, the member states share their, let's say, competences with the EU. And then the third dimension, the intergovernmental dimension, where the member states remain firmly in the driving seat. Here we're talking about CFSP, CSDP, the Common Foreign and Security Policy, and the Common Security and Defense Policy. We're going to look closer into these after the coffee break. When it comes to the first dimension, I don't know whether can we get this back on the screen. Okay, thank you. When it comes to who is doing what, sorry that something is blocking here. I cannot. Can you help me to switch the slides, please? Or where do I have to point? Because they do not. Okay, now something is going to happen. So for the shared competences, the exclusive competences, that this is where the union method applies, where the commission tables initial proposals and then the parliament and the council co-decide. For CFSP, CSDP, it's a very different picture. Here we have the council, the member states in the driving seat with the EAS. Quick scan now, the common commercial policy, trade policy, the most integrated one of the oldest but also the most relevant of the external policies, I dare to say, because when it comes to this one, trade, the EU is without doubt a superpower. Nobody's contesting this. The EU is the biggest trading bloc in the world, far ahead of the US and China. And in trade, size matters. This is the principle in trade. Size matters. The biggest trading blocks, they are the rule makers, whereas the other one, the smaller ones, are consumers of rules, norm takers. So here the EU is a superpower. For other areas, development policy, CFSP, you can debate about this, but for common commercial policy, trade policy, no doubt. Interesting also, the Lisbon Treaty added this small last phrase, which is highlighted here, that still the common commercial policy shall be used in the context of the principles and objectives of the EU external action, meaning, well, in fact, what does it mean? Does, when we conclude a free trade agreement, we should have as much the our noble objectives like human rights and the rule of law in mind as much as the interests of our producers and exporters? Well, just there is a debate on this, and different actors have different interpretations of these. Now, then development policy. Now, this is, together with the trade policy, one of the policies which have been in the EU's on the treaties since the very beginning, since the Rome Treaty in 1950s. And the EU takes pride of being the biggest provider of official development assistance to the world. However, this being a shared competence, the biggest donor, yes, but in fact it is the member states individually that are the biggest donor. The EU, what comes from the budget is only a relatively small part of it, because this is a parallel competence where both the member states and the union act in parallel. Also, the Lisbon Treaty has introduced some new interesting changes, because it has reduced the objectives of development policy to basically one, which is the reduction and, in long term, the eradication of poverty. That's it. Full stop, basically. Yeah? Before, the list of objectives was longer. It was also, one of the objectives was the mutual gradual integration of developing countries in the world economy. This is no longer there. In 2009, most countries thought that this sounded a little bit too paternalistic, you know, the old approach to development policy. And also, since the situation has changed, most poor people in the world do not live in the poorest country. Most poor people live in lower and lower middle income countries like Nigeria, Indonesia, and others. So this is to take account of a new reality and a new approach to development policy. Now, next ones on the EU list of external policies, although we could debate whether this is really a fully-fledged external policy or not, rather an internal policy, this is the famous Article 49. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you probably, if you were asked to quote or to cite one article from the treaties, the article which would probably come immediately to your mind would be what? Article 50, I would suppose. So we all know what Article 50 is about. Article 50 is how to leave the European Union. When I started working for the European Commission about, 18 years ago, the most widely debated article in the treaties was this one, Article 49. And what does Article 49 tell you? How to get into the EU. You see the logic: 49, how to get in, 50, how to get out. And the fact that 20 years ago this was the most widely debated article when the EU was preparing itself to make the jump from 15 to 25 member states, that shows us how much the context has changed. We are operating in a completely different context. Now, question still, is enlargement policy an external policy or an internal policy? depending from whom you ask. If you go to the council, to the member states, to the ES, probably most people will tell you, oh, it's clearly an external policy because we're dealing with third countries. Go to the commission, to commission officials, ask them about enlargement. They say, well, no, you see, the objective of enlargement policy is to help these countries to adopt the acquis in order to become members of the common, of the single market of the EU. So the finalité, the final objective is to integrate them. Not really rather an internal policy. So you see, it's a bit on the brink. You can argue both ways. As for migration, is migration policy, first and foremost an external or an internal policy? Also, you can, argue both ways. Now, however, if you look at enlargement from a foreign policy perspective, you can safely say that it was the most successful for EU foreign policy we ever had. Why? Well, take a classical definition of foreign policy. What is foreign policy? To nudge other countries into behaving in a way that it suits our interest, that it suits us. This worked perfectly well with enlargement policy, because I remember myself having worked for the European Commission in one of the countries that became member in 2004. It was enough for the Commission to go to the government and say, we ask you to do this and this reform and this reform and to change that law, and a few months later or a year later it was done. Right? For someone as me who comes from an old member state, this was quite amazing to see this. So, most successful foreign policy, which leads us to the next one, this one, European neighbor policy, which I would say is a bit a kind of copy-paste of enlargement policy. That goes back to former Commission President Romano Prodi in 2003, when he proposed that the enlarged EU should be surround itself with a ring of friends. That was at the time when... Thank you. Many of us flocked to the cinema to watch The Lord of the Rings. You see, sometimes in commission communications you have little nods to popular culture. And the basic operating mode of the neighborhood policy, what he proposed, was same as for enlargement policy. Assistance and a political perspective, like opening our markets, visa-free travel or visa liberalization in exchange for reforms. That didn't really work. I mean, after looking back at, 15, 16 years of neighborhood policy, very few would say that was a big success. Look at what happened during the Arab uprising in Ukraine and others. I mean, maybe the first misunderstanding was that European neighborhood policy is not our neighbors. It's not about our neighbors. And it's not about our relations with Turkey, with Norway, with Switzerland, with Russia. Now, it's a political construct, sort of arbitrarily chosen number of countries, which most of them are our neighbors, but for others like Azerbaijan and Jordan, you could argue. By the way, what is this map here showing is also how the EU can sometimes get creative when it comes for working around potential problems. I can remember that a few years ago I was in the MEDA secretariat in Barcelona giving a presentation together with our colleagues from ENA to diplomats from the Euromed group. And we had this map, but without the little blue label down on the corner down left. And we had the same map without this little label, showing our version of it, meaning a border of Morocco being in the middle of the Sahara. And there in the group we had two Moroccan diplomats who went red in their faces and who jumped up and left the room in protest, because their version of where the borders of Morocco should lie was a different one from us. And it took everyone, the organizers, quite a bit of time getting them back in the room. So, well, in the EU, what do you do if you have a problem that you can't solve? You work around it, you put a sticker on the map, and it's problem solved. No discussion. So, anyway, the neighborhood policy, was meant to group these countries together, which have nothing in common, to have a common approach, and very quickly it became clear that with one size fits all approach didn't work. So it was split up between neighborhood south, neighborhood east. There are many, quite a number of people in the EU who would find that it didn't justify itself. However, it is probably going to continue, because also the biggest benefit, it seems, from the neighborhood policy is now that it brings together, it forces the member state to sit together and to discuss, to have a common approach to regions which otherwise they would not have a common approach. Otherwise, without the neighborhood policy, and some of our member states would focus very much on what's happening in the south, others very much focusing on the east. At least here it forces the member states to sit together and to define a common approach. Well, then, of course, and here I will be quite quick, because this will be subject of the next presentation, CFSP, CSDP, the intergovernmental part. Now, if you look at what the treaty says, it becomes very clear that this is not a policy like the others. First of all, you find it not in the TFEU, the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, which gives the, let's say, operational guidance on how to run the EU, but in the political part, the TEU. And you see there is not much in terms of a role for the Commission. The Commission is basically absent, the Parliament is absent, the Court of Justice is absent. No legislative acts. How much the Parliament is absent is, you realize this when you look at Article 36 about the rights of the European Parliament. And here we're talking about the European Parliament, of course, not the national parliaments. They have the right to be regularly consulted. They have the right to ask questions to the Council, and they may be involved in briefing, so not really superpowers. Now, the Lisbon Treaty that entered into force in 2009 quite overhauled the system in which the EU organized its external action, its external relation. But maybe now, at this point, I don't know whether there are at this point already any questions. Now, since I've done a quick scan of the biggest policies before I go into the institutional setups post-Lisbon, I can't see the no comments in the chat function, so I go on. Now, there was one big problem we had in the EU after Maastricht and before Lisbon, meaning that we had different sets of policies. So the one, most of them supranational, where the union method applied, like trade, development, enlargement. So, and then the other, which was in the hands of the government, CFSP, and the two wouldn't come together. The two were completely uncoordinated. There was no passerelle between the two. No one who could express the EU's view on all the different aspects. And this created a lot of problems. I remember some even court cases where the Commission and the Council fought each other in front of the court of who of them should have the right to run a certain program in West Africa to disarm rebels and to train them to make them change their Kalashnikovs against agricultural tools. The Council was claiming that this was security policy, this was their domain réservé. The Commission was claiming this is development policy, give it to us. And they had to confront themselves in front of the Court of Justice to sort this out. So that wasn't really an hour of glory for the EU, and everybody understood that the system had to change. Other problem related to the representation of the EU, the visibility. Now, Some of you might know this gentleman, Henry Kissinger. Some of you might recognize him. Why is he there? Because he coined this famous phrase in the 1970s. If I want to call the EU, which phone number do I dial? Because there was no one being able to talk about on behalf of the EU as a whole. Now, the Lisbon Treaty has solved this problem in a quite clever way by introducing this position. This gentleman, now his full job title is the High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy / Vice President of the European Commission. That sounds a little bit heavy, so we call him now the HRVP. If in 2005 the voters in France and in the Netherlands wouldn't have rejected the project for a European constitution, his title would be now the European Foreign Minister. That didn't happen, so we stick to HRVP. And he basically, his added value is that he combines two roles. He is the foreign policy chief, so the former Mr. Solana, the high representative for common foreign security policy. As such, he does basically the same thing as former Solana. He's he's seen as the equivalent of a EU foreign minister, and he is double-headed as the vice president of the Commission, in charge of coordinating all the external action portfolios that fall into the Commission's remit, whether it is development, trade, humanitarian assistance, migration, enlargement, neighborhood, and so. So, basically, to visualize this, he is the boss on both sides, both CFSP, CSDP, both in the other supranational policies. Now, it's quite a brilliant idea, simple idea. However, the devil is always in the detail, because he is not the only one to represent the EU when it comes to CFSP, because there's also this gentleman, Mr. Michel, the European Council President. If you look at his job description in the treaty, it says he shall, at his level and that capacity, ensure the external representation of the Union on issues concerning its common foreign and security policy without prejudice to the powers of the High Representative. Now, how should we read this? Shall we read this, that what is the relation between the two? Okay, he is the president, the other, Borrell, we said, okay, more or less the equivalent of a foreign minister, meaning the relation between these two is basically the same as the relation between the President Trump and Foreign Secretary Pompeo, a president and foreign minister. It's not as easy as this, because there is no hierarchical subordination between the two. Mr. Borrell has been appointed by the member states separately. There is no institutional link to the president, so the president cannot, Mr. Michel cannot give any orders to him, which you can easily imagine that can be a recipe for problems. However, if both sides agree that we should avoid this kind of situation, and then it may work, and until now it worked quite well. I mean, it's been on for a decade. So now let's go to the other side of the second job of Mr. Borrell, the Vice President of the European Commission. As such, the treaty says he shall ensure the consistency of the EU's external action and be responsible within the Commission for responsibilities in external relation. Now, what does that mean? Here, if we look at the organigram of the European Commission, we see that, you know, we have one president, then we have several vice presidents, and one of the vice presidents is the high representative / vice president, and he is there to coordinate the work of the other commissioners in charge, which have external relations portfolios, so trade, development, development, which is now called international partnerships, enlargement, neighborhood, and others. Yes, this word coordination. Now, coordination sounds very friendly, right? We all like coordination, unless we are being coordinated by someone else, because it implies a certain hierarchical relationship. It implies that someone is able to tell you what to do and to tell others what to do and not. This might make sense. However, if you look at the commissioners, I mean, is this a hierarchical body? Do you have a hierarchy between commissioners? Well, you have the president, which is primus inter pares, but then the commissioners are, even if they are vice presidents and other ranked commissioners, there's not supposed to be hierarchy between two, and also politically, that would be quite difficult to impose such a hierarchy, because most member states see their commissioner still as one of theirs and would like to have their commissioner have a junior role. I have to say, 10 years ago, probably few people would have thought that this system would really work. In fact, now it works quite well. It has been set up by the former commission by Mr. Juncker, and yes, it works. It seems to work, but it's also here again we have to look at the context, because where we are, this happened after the big economic and financial crisis of 2008-2009, followed by the euro crisis, where the EU was really had a legitimacy problem for many Europeans. And here the idea was, okay, if we want to prove our added value and pass the message that we are, there is a purpose for us being there and doing what we want, then we have to get our acts together and prove also to the citizens that we can work in a more coordinated way, that we can produce better value for money and stop our turf fights we had before. So a lot of we have to see this in the context. Okay, that was the HRVP, but then to make a complicated story even more complicated, we shouldn't forget that lady, the President of the European Commission, Mrs. von der Leyen, and the treaty say also, with the exception for the common foreign and security policy and other cases provided for in the treaties, which basically refers to the economic and monetary union, the Commission shall ensure the union's external representation. Okay, if I throw you the question now, yeah, who finally represents the EU? Would you find it easy to answer? Imagine if Donald Trump comes to Brussels, who is going to meet him? Mr. Borrell, Mr. Michel, Ms. von der Leyen? Well, I'm sorry I didn't find a more recent photos with the present cast, but this shows you a bit what the arrangements are. Now, when the president comes to Brussels, of course he wants to meet the president, right? Not the high representative. That would be counterpart of his foreign minister. He wants to see the president. However, this being the EU, okay, we have two presidents. One, remember the job description of the president of the European Council, is in charge of the common foreign and security policy. So meaning if Donald Trump wants to discuss the fight against global terrorism or the against the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, he has to speak to the president of the European Council. He is competent. However, if he wants to speak about trade for the state of the global economy. He has to go and talk to the president of the European Commission. That's how it is. Now, for his foreign minister, it would be much easier because Mr. Pompeo could just meet the Mr. Borrell, the HRVP, and Mr. Borrell, he could talk with Mr. Trump about everything, from terrorism to trade. But Mr. Borrell is the only person in the world who has this competence, who is double-headed. He has, as HRVP, no deputy, meaning if ever he goes on sick leave, then we're back to square one. Then, of course, you can ask someone to represent him, for example, another commissioner, but this other commissioner has a strictly limited mandate. He cannot talk about, say, weapons of mass destruction. Or he can go to the rotating presidency and ask the rotating presidency to step in for him. But the rotating presidency then cannot talk about trade. Right. So, see, devil is in the detail here. Also, the same thing is when it comes to the G7, G8, who goes and represents the EU at the G20. Who represents the EU there? Also, excuse me, that photo is a little bit older because of Corona. I couldn't find a newer one. Here, again, you have our dynamic duo, two presidents, one commission president, one president of the European Council, one delegation consisting of two members. See, in the EU, everything is a little bit more complicated than elsewhere. Now, okay, so far for the representation competences, again, I make a small pause in case there are any questions and comments.
I believe in Zoom, Anna Isidoro, she has a question for you.
Yes, with pleasure. Is there, okay, so can we give her the microphone or is the question in written?
I believe she asked to pose her question at the end of the presentation. So she asked to pose her question at the end of the presentation?
Okay. Yeah. Then we can wait until the end.
Okay. But in the end, fine. Okay. Well, a few words about the External Action Service, another strange animal brought to us by the Lisbon Treaty. Now with the External Action Service, we have finally the EU has its own diplomatic service. Again, first reflex always, if you want to know a little bit more about the role, how it works, is to go into the treaties, look at the treaties. The treaties are doesn't go very into detail, says that this is this service shall assist the High Representative and work in cooperation with the diplomatic services of the member states, shall comprise officials from the relevant departments of the Council, the Commission, as well as staff seconded from the member states. So, basically, this is then how it looks like. We took, in 2010, when the service was set up, we took some departments, DG RELEX, parts of DG DEFCO from the Commission, parts of the Council Secretariat, and then we asked the member states to send their diplomats. We shake this, and this gives the European the European Diplomatic Service. The rules were defined at the later stage. It said that at least one-third of staff should come from the member states, 60% from EU officials to prevent a hostile takeover from the member states. And there were some concerns at that time, that especially about the role of the member state diplomats here, because I don't know whether you've heard this famous quip, which is attributed to George Soros, about the difference between member state diplomats and EU officials. It goes like this: member state diplomats, they have interests and no values. And EU officials, it's the other way around. Of course, this is a bit, let's say, a meant to be a joke, but there is an element of truth in it, because if you're a national diplomat, what is your job description? To defend the interest of your country. If you're a commission official working for DG DEFCO, then you don't have this limitation. Then you're bound by the principles by the treaty, work towards the eradication of poverty, and so on. Well, after a decade, finally, we found out that in principle the system works quite well. There is, of course, anecdotal evidence of some heads of some national diplomats who act as heads of EU delegations now, sometimes seem to forget that they work in the interest of the EU, but rather in the interest of their member states, also knowing that these diplomats, after their stint at the EAS, which lasts from 4 to 10 years, are supposed to go back to their home countries and continue their diplomatic career there. But generally, it seems to be working quite well, having in mind that the ES has some limitations, because even if it's called External Action Service, their competences are rather limited. For example, they have no competence for trade policy, no competence when it comes to enlargement policy or humanitarian aid. Now, trade, this is clear, this is an exclusive competence of the European Commission, where the Commission speaks on behalf of the member states, and for the Commission that would be kind of a rollback if we given a body which is not a supranational body, where we have member state diplomats to decide about trade policy. Now, development assistance, at least the parts that deal with signing, spending money, managing development assistance, that's also outside of the remit of the EEAS. Why? Because this is about executing the EU's budget. And according to the EU treaties, the only institution that can execute the EU's budget is the European Commission. So, the EEAS has no power to implement, to run projects programs that involve spending EU development assistance. So here the ES relies on the European Commission. If you go, in fact, in a EU delegation in any, let's say, in a developing country, these days all the EU delegations are under the EES, but in most delegations the majority of staff still works are commission officials working for the commission, so you have kind of a double line of command. Well, I should stop here and talking about institutional arrangements and developments, maybe to go a little bit more towards the presidency and the role of the rotating presidency in external relations, and also to highlight a few points that might come up of the agenda of this presidency. Now, having said this, we are all aware that after the Lisbon Treaty, the role of the rotating presidency in external action, in external relation, is strictly limited. Now, before Lisbon, it was the rotating presidency that chaired the Foreign Affairs Council, or was it what was called the General Affairs and Foreign Affairs Council. Now, this is now done by the High Representative. This is the only council formation which is chaired by a permanent president, which has taken out much of the, let's say, glory of running a presidency, and especially the smaller countries now resent it. Now imagine, in former times before Lisbon, once every so many years, if a small the Prime Minister of Malta and or Cyprus could go on the international stage and say, I'm talking on behalf of the European Union. These days are gone. So quite some member states regret now that they have traded off the chair of the Foreign Affairs Council to the EAS and to the High Representative. However, the benefit of it is well known. It gives for more continuity in external affairs. However, what the rotating presidency has retained are still the chairmanship of some of the external relations related working parties, the working groups. So whereas the geographical ones are now these days mostly chaired by the EAS, some, like the one on trade, like the one on enlargement, on development, on sanctions, are still chaired by the rotating presidency. So here is a role for the presidency. And another role for the presidency is when it comes to signing international agreements. As long as they are mixed agreement meaning concluded between the EU and its member states on one side, which in fact is the case for the big majority of all international agreements. Now, all major trade agreements, partnership agreements, so come as mixed agreement, which require the signature and ratification by all the member states. Here, as you see on this picture, you see the CETA, the Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement with Canada, was signed in 2017. Here it was not only the Commission President, the European Council President, was also the that was under the Slovak presidency, the Slovak Premier Minister, who signed this treaty on behalf of the rotating presidency. So here, an important role for the rotating presidency. Now, when it comes to the national parliaments, again, fortunately, foreign policy is at EU level at least an area where the role of already the European Parliament is strictly limited. Now, in the member states, then when it comes to the ratification of agreements, for example, that depends on the member state, on the constitutional arrangement within the member state, whether the parliament is involved or not. But in most member states, they are definitely, they have a role in ratification of international agreements. Not only the national parliaments, by the way, also sometimes subnational parliaments, regional parliaments. You might remember the CETA saga, the Canada Free Trade Agreement, which was holed up because one regional government, one regional parliament, one out of six parliaments in Belgium, decided that they would now rather, that Belgium should rather not sign this agreement. So they had the constitutional right. They, without their consent, the government couldn't sign it. So this was after diffused, but that shows the power of parliaments in the ratification, in the procedure of international agreements, again, in some member states more than in others. Then, of course, the national parliaments have a role in the COSAC, in particular now here the Interparliamentary Conference for CFSP and CSDP, which is done by each rotating presidency. Now, the German one, that due to COVID had to be done via Zoom, which has the benefit at least now that it is on in its entirety on YouTube, and you can follow the debates. If you've missed it, if you were not there, then it's in full length on YouTube. So this is an important format for national MPs to come together and to debate the issues that are on the agenda of the rotating presidency, which brings us now to the agenda of the rotating presidency. And here I have to admit, ladies and gentlemen, that this part of the presentation was for me the most difficult one. Why? Because in external action, more than elsewhere, the agenda is driven by events. Right? Things that you cannot really plan ahead. Now, who of us had Nagorno-Karabakh on the agendas until a week ago, right? No one. And now it's on top on our agenda. Now, I looked at the trio program from the German, Portuguese, and Slovak presidency, the trio program. Well, Belarus was not even mentioned. Of course, Nagorno-Karabakh was not mentioned. I think so. You see, this is events-driven, highly susceptible to the disruption. Of course, COVID-19 is another factor which doesn't allow for correct planning. We can, of course, assume that there will be certain things on our agenda. The trio program gives us already an idea. However, the trio program is also very, let's say, extensive. You have a lot of regions and countries listed there. They might or might not find themselves on the agenda of your presidency. So, however, there are a few which we can reasonably assume will be there. If we look at the... will be there. I mean, for example, we don't know what is going to happen with the UK, whether we will have an agreement until the end of the year. If not, then sure, it will be on the agenda. There will be other issues now, for example, like enlargement. This has been a constant on any presidency, almost any presidency's agenda over the last 20 years. And enlargement, which is now, has become in Brussels a synonym for Western Balkans. Now, we know, of course, that Turkey is still a candidate country, but we also understand, and the Turks understand, that this is going nowhere. And although nobody has dared pulling the plug yet, also as a face-saving exercise, in the member state there is, in most member states, there is little enthusiasm for further enlargements. Okay, we know that the accession negotiations with Albania and Northern Macedonia are supposed to start at some time, but really, is that really on top of our priorities? And also most of our politicians know that they do not have a lot of votes to gain when they lobby for enlargement. However, we all understand that it is important to keep the enlargement process on track so that these countries, the countries of the Western Balkans, keep their reform agenda on track and don't fall back into old habits. Another thing that might be on the agenda, and this depends, of course, on the outcome of the U.S. elections in November, the trade relations with the U.S. If Trump stays there, nothing will change. If Mr. Biden wins, then that might be back on the agenda. I remind you, we had since 2013 negotiated a huge free trade agreement with the U.S., and when Mr. Trump came to power, he pulled the plug, so that was on ice. Now that we had even a small trade war between the U.S. and the EU, and that was diffused now since we've signed a small, very shallow tariff agreement, which is hard to get enthusiastic about, but we all understand this is not the real thing. So if the situation changed, that might be back on our agenda. Having said this, this will also be an uphill struggle in our member states, because such an agreement is far from being popular in our member states. Now, we all like trade, but in the EU, we somehow got used of being, as I mentioned in the beginning, the ones who write the rules of trade. And when we sign a free trade agreement with, let's say, Ukraine, then that's very clear. We write the rules, and we expect Ukraine to stick to them. It's clearly written in these agreements. The aim is that the partner country aligns its legislation on the EU's legislation. If we do this with a partner like the U.S., it doesn't work like this. It's taking and giving. We are no longer only the norm maker. We might also be norm takers and have to adapt our rules on food safety and others in order to concessions on other areas.
EU Switzerland might be there. You know, this is the forgotten crisis, which was completely overshadowed by Brexit. But you remember in 2014, the Swiss voted in a referendum against for curbing the freedom of movement for EU citizens, which brought the EU-Switzerland relations into deep crisis. And now this crisis only has been diffused a couple of weeks ago when they had a second referendum where basically they said, oh, we didn't mean it like this, and so we won't do it. However, the EU is now insisting that all the 20 sectoral agreements we have with Switzerland will be replaced by one comprehensive agreement. The Swiss, we have negotiated an agreement, but this being Switzerland, this has to be ratified by through a referendum. We don't know whether this is going to happen. Then the neighborhood, this is the big constant sources of crisis, whether it's in the south like Libya or in the east like Nagorno-Karabakh or Belarus. We can expect to have a big dose of this neighborhood on our agenda. And then we have some other items which are not crisis-driven and which are also close to the heart of a priority for the Portuguese presidency, for example, above all, EU-India. So we have negotiated. There is an EU-India summit scheduled for March, is it, I think. And the idea is to sign a free trade agreement, which we have been negotiating for the last 13 years, since 2007. It seems that we are coming to the end line, although there are still some problems with regards to intellectual property, with regards to market access, but there are rather positive signs. EU-Africa, this is what Portuguese presidency is likely to inherit from the German presidency due to Corona. There was a big EU-Africa summit scheduled for October, and at this summit a new strategic partnership between the EU and Africa should have been signed, between the European Union and the African Union should have been signed. Now with Corona, both sides decided that it was not the right moment to make 54 mostly elderly men, heads of state from Africa, travel to Brussels, so that was postponed. So the Portuguese presidency is going to inherit this. This process of signing a new strategic partnership with Africa pretty much shifted to the sidelines another process, which is the update of the Cotonou Agreement, which expires end of 2020. Now, this Cotonou Agreement or its successor, many question the need for or its raison d'être, because this is seen in particular by many of our African partners as a sort of expression of the old-fashioned relationship between a donor and a recipient. It's about giving money in exchange for reforms. Our African partners, they're much more keen on having an agreement where they look eye to eye, like the strategic partnership with Africa, which is more political and partnership between equals. So that and Latin America, Caribbean, there's EU-Mexico, the global agreement with Mexico, the trade pillar of the global agreement with Mexico is ready for signature and might be signed. This is a major agreement which updates the old trade agreement we had from the 1990s. The EU-Chile trade agreement is up for renewal. And then, of course, there's Mercosur. Last year, after 20 years of negotiations, we have agreed on a new agreement with Mercosur. However, like the U.S. agreement, this is not popular in many member states, and there are doubts in many member states about the seriousness of the Bolsonaro administration to honor their commitments on climate change and the protection on the Amazon. And also our farmers do not like this, so big question marks about this. And then we have a flurry of other free trade agreements, Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia. We have still the crisis at the WTO, the dispute resolution mechanism being dysfunctional, but then it depends also on the outcome of the US election. And yes, many, many more. Again, all these might be on the agenda of the Portuguese presidency unless, of course, they're overshadowed by other issues which we don't even have an idea about. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I think I will stop here because we have sort of, I talked too long, but we have 15 minutes left, and as I understand, there are already some questions, so let's go then into question, answers, comments from your side, a little debate. So, thank you for your attention. And, yes.
Anna, are you with us?
Can you hear us, Anna?
I can see you turned on your mic.
Anna, I'm not sure if you're speaking, but I don't think we can hear anything.
I think she can hear us. She turned on her mic.
Can you hear us?
She can't hear us. Well, go ahead with your question, Anna.
Or maybe she can just type the question in the chat.
Yeah, perhaps she should type the question in the chat
so
because
we
cannot hear her. Sorry, Anna.
So we'll just give it a minute for her to type the question. Thank you, Wolfgang. That was a very interesting presentation. Thank you.
Perhaps there's someone else who would like to ask a question, because Anna, I think, needs a little bit of time to formulate her question. I don't know if there's anyone in the room that has a question for Wolfgang after his presentation.
We're still having 15 minutes, so it would be nice to discuss a bit.
We'll break now, and we can pick up the question when we come back. Okay.
So,
15 minutes. We'll be back at 15:20. Anna, can you hear us?
Anna? Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, perfectly. Let's just give it a few more minutes, then we'll start, and I'll call you your name, okay?
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, welcome back, everyone. We will start with our last session of the day, but before, Anna had a question. Anna, please go ahead.
Oh, hello. My name is Anna Isidoro. I work, I'm advisor in the Division of International Relations and Cooperation of the Assembly of Republic of Portugal. And my job is to advise the permanent delegation of the Assembly of the Republic to the Parliamentary Assembly of the Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe, as well as parliamentary cooperation with the National Assembly of Angola. So, as you mentioned about Ukraine, Belarus, and Nagorno-Karabakh. And we have an existence of three conflict situations in these three regions that in the area of our European neighborhood policy, namely Ukraine with Crimea, Belarus with the failure of the Senate delegation for international elections and the non-recognition of the president, and now Nagorno-Karabakh. And my question is, what are the European Union's current policies towards these countries, and what we can expect in the future about these three developments?
Thank you, Anna. Wolfgang?
Yes, thank you. Well, what are the Europeans' policies towards these three regions? I mean, we have to realize that when we're talking about the neighborhood, we're talking about individual relations which each country, you know, it's EU Belarus, it's EU EU Ukraine, so there is little in terms of a coherent approach, and this the policy is driven by, let's say, it's the lowest common denominator. It's what we can agree upon, and we have seen in the case of Belarus. Now, it was, I just read that yesterday, apparently Cyprus decided to agree on the embargo, on sanctions against against Belarus, which before that was for 1 week or so, which was blocked because one country accounting for 0.2% of the EU's population was able to block the adoption of a decision which wasn't really controversial, which everybody agreed should happen, but for tactical reason. And that shows a bit the limitations we have here. When we looked at Ukraine, okay, Ukraine was, in the Crimea, I think, was a relatively easy thing because Russia behaved so badly. It was so obvious that they're breaking all international norms that finally the EU had not much options than to agreeing on a set of sanctions. For some place like Nagorno-Karabakh, it's much more difficult because, again, we have, different countries with different priorities. We have Turkey involved, and Turkey, we all know that Turkey has a certain nuisance power due to the migration deal. So if they open the borders, the land borders, we have a big problem. And then again, they're all, not all EU member states are singing from the same song sheet. The big problem here is really that the unanimity rule, and that for everything we have to decide by unanimity. So I found it quite interesting then already then the new Commission President, Mr. von der Leyen, came when became Commission President, then she already advocated for the abolishment of the unanimity rule, not in external relations, not for everything, but at least for human rights violation and sanctions. That might, I mean, at first sight, that you might say, oh, this is quite the normal. I mean, that's the common sense that would tell you to do so. But on the other hand, also I hear from within the EAS that they do not like too much the idea. Why? Because if we have qualified majority, even in CFSP, then some countries might be even less inclined to stick to the what was agreed than they are now. And here we have from the migration deal 2015 a clear example how that could play out. If we force down a deal on some countries and who have no possibility to object, so it might be much harder to implement this. But nevertheless, I don't know whether this has real chances, but I think it's already a good worth trying. Maybe also something the Portuguese presidency might want to advocate for. Well, otherwise, yes, according to come back to the question, what is the EU's approach or strategy towards these countries? I'm afraid, no, the strategy is what we can agree upon, and whether it makes sense or not, but that's it. That's how foreign policy works. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Wolfgang. Perhaps we can move on to the second, the last session, if there are no other questions.
Okay, thank you. If you allow me, I will stand, because otherwise it feels... feels strange for me to be seated and not be able to move around. So, okay, the last session, ladies and gentlemen, was about external action as a whole. As I said, external action is the totality of all the EU policies and instruments with regards to the outside world. Now we're going to a little bit more into the intergovernmental dimension, CFSP, CSDP, in particular the CSDP. Having said with this one, CSDP, as the name says, has, you know, it stands for Common Security and Defense Policy. And if we look at this, over the Common Security and Defense Policy has been in place for about, well, what is it, 20 years. Now, and for the first
60-70 years, it was more CSP, common security policy. The defense part, the D in CSDP, came only at a very late stage. And I'm not going to talk too much today about the D part, the common defense policy, because that would really bring us on another terrain, but I'm going to mention it. Just to remind you of that, the intergovernmental dimension, the member states firmly staying in the driving seat. Now, the common foreign and security policy that exists almost 30 years since the Maastricht Treaty, CSDP came a decade later. And if you look at the components, security and defense, and now we realize that, security and defense, who in Europe is in charge of security and defense? Wasn't there someone else? But before that, just to look at the structures within the CFSP, CSDP, who makes decisions, and here we can see that we are very far away from the other parts of EU policies. You know, when we see how decision makes in the European for the EU policies, with the role of the Commission, with the role of the Parliament, the Council. We have all these different interactions. Here it's quite clear. We have one body which is in charge, which is the Council. We have on the operational sides a few preparatory bodies within the EAS, which are listed there. I don't want to go to the details. We have special organs in the Council, like a Political and Security Committee, which does broadly what the COREPER does otherwise. Then we have the Foreign Affairs Council, headed by the by a permanent president, which is the High Representative. And this former Foreign Affairs Council then adopts decision by unanimity. Now, these decisions are political decisions. There is no legislation here. There are no legislative acts here. Question now, you see, Parliament is absent. Is the Commission there somewhere? Well, yes and no. The Commission isn't on this organigram, but the Commission is still on the table in the person of Mr. Borrell, who, as you remember, has a second job as double-headed as the Commission Vice President for External Relations. So this is a feature, then, as you remember, that has been introduced by Lisbon to ensure coherence and consistency between the different policies. So meaning whenever you have the President of the European Affairs Council, you automatically have a Vice President of the Commission at table. Now, going again to my previous, back to my previous question, yes, do we need a common foreign and security policy, a common security and defense policy, since we have, as we all know, another actor in Europe who is taking care of security and defense. Now, for foreign policy, seeing it is. Now, every member state has its own foreign policy, security and defense. Well, obviously, there is this other actor, which is NATO. And in fact, as we have seen, CFSP, CSDP came to the EU's were added to the EU's toolbox only at a quite late stage in Maastricht and in Lisbon, respectively, because many member states said, why should we have our own security and defense policy if we have NATO? Why have a Fiat 500 if we have a Rolls-Royce already? To which some would say, well, with a Rolls-Royce, you can't drive on every road. There are some roads where you can only drive with a smaller car. But there was still the feeling that there was a distinct need for a European security and defense policy. We'll see why. Having said this, the relations between NATO and the EU haven't always been easy, haven't always been smooth. For about
more than a decade, they were quasi inexistent. For more than a decade, the two organizations wouldn't talk to each other. And that started after 2004, when one country entered the European Union, which was not at speaking terms with one of NATO's member states. And this NATO member state would not even and still does not recognize this particular country. So, and then all the cooperation at strategic level, exchange of information at strategic level stopped. There was silence radio for more than a decade. Now, this is illustrated nicely by this cartoon. So, in case you were wondering about which country I was talking. But also we realize from this that, yes, 21 of the 27 member states are already members of NATO. So there is a certain dédoublement, a certain question is why then this CFSP, CSDP, why would we need this? In order to illustrate this, I think we have to fast rewind for about 30 years. But before that, maybe just to illustrate that this ice age between the EU and NATO came to an end in 2016, and suddenly the two organizations started talking again to each other, as we see in here. And since then, well, we can talk about a new spring of EU-NATO relations. And why 2016? What changed in 2016? Well, you might remember 2016 was our annus horribilis. It was not only the year when we had Brexit and when Donald Trump was elected. It was also the year when we saw the putsch in Turkey. It was the year after the big refugee crisis, 2 years after Russia militarily aggressed Ukraine and occupied the Crimea. So all these events prompted a rethinking on both sides and saying, okay, yes, in fact, both organizations are struggling with the same problems, especially since also as over the last 30 years, the EU and in particular during the last 10 years, EU and NATO started to compete on the same territory, on the same terrain. It's after NATO started doing out-of-area missions. And the EU started doing the same thing. So a lot of dédoublement, let's say. And then in 2016, as we were all on the deepest point of a decade of crisis, that made both sides reconsider, can we really afford these two organizations doing similar things but not talking to each other? So, you see, sometimes a crisis can also be good for some things. In this case, the crisis or the string of crises prompted the two organizations to make a new start together. Now, going back a little bit to the rationale why we started considering a common foreign and security and common security and defense policy, then we have to rewind back about 30 years. The older ones in the room, the ones of my age or above, you probably remember this, what we saw on our screens live in December 1991. The Yugoslav troops shelling the old town of Dubrovnik in Croatia, known to the younger generation as King's Landing from Game of Thrones. And that was at a time when we had just still were in a state of enthusiasm just after the fall of the Iron Curtain, the Berlin Wall, when Francis Fukuyama talked about the end of history, when we thought we were entering now in a period that where a military confrontation between states, between countries, would belong to the dustbin of history. Yeah? And then that came as a shock, live on our TV screens. Now, we were asking ourselves then, okay, where's NATO? What is NATO doing? NATO was saying, sorry guys, we are a territorial defense pact and nobody has aggressed us, so we are not competent. The European community, no, nothing. They had no means and also not much, not enough political will probably to act, but especially no means to act, even although that this conflict was right at their doorsteps. The UN, no, this is an internal conflict of a sovereign country. We are not competent. OSCE could have done something, but Russia, as a member, casted a veto, thought it was not appropriate. So this is then prompted the heads of state and of government in the same month in Maastricht to agree on a common foreign and security policy, saying we have to be able, as Europeans, to speak with one voice. Also, the other member states of the European community at the time were quite cross with Germany when Germany unilaterally recognized Croatia and Slovenia. So that was the motivation, setting up a common foreign and security policy, being able to speak with one voice, however, making it clear, as the treaty shows us, that this policy remains firmly in the hands of the member states. So no transfer of powers to the supranational level, to the commission, to the parliament. No, the member states stay the masters of the game, everything done at unanimity, no commission, no parliament. Clearly understandable because here we are talking about areas which most states consider as the hardcore of their state sovereignty. Foreign policy, security policy. This is different from agriculture, transport, fishery, right? The fact that we had now after 1993, when the Maastricht Treaty came into being, a common foreign and security policy, does that mean that, okay, now problem solved, something like in Croatia and in Dubrovnik in 91 couldn't repeat itself? You know the rest of the story. You know what happened in Bosnia in 95, 96, in Kosovo in 98, 99. Where was the EU? Where was the common foreign and security policy? Don't say they didn't do anything. They did a lot. Adopting a lot of joint actions and common positions and condemning in the strongest terms the killings of civilians and the ethnical cleansings in former Yugoslavia. Most observers came to the agreed that this made only limited impact on Mr. Milosevic and Mr. Mladic and the like. So this is why in 1999, coincidence or not, 1 week after the war in Kosovo stopped, the member states agreed to have a common security and defense policy. Now, I remind you that the wars in Bosnia and in Kosovo only stopped after NATO intervened, NATO led by the US, and started a bombing campaign in Bosnia and in Kosovo, and that stopped the war. Now, today, if you go to, for example, to a place like Kosovo, and I know a bit about this because I was working 4 years for the European Commission in Kosovo, you find a lot of American flags, you find a lot of street signs named after former U.S. presidents, although sometimes with a dodgy orthography, like this or like this. You don't find any Jacques Santerre or Manuel Barroso Street. Sometimes, recognize this one, this lady. And, yes, this statue in downtown Pristina, that is not Jacques Santerre. This is president of the commission. This is Bill Clinton. So, see, the U.S., very popular, the most popular country in a place like Kosovo, which is, by the way, a Muslim country. The EU... Why not? And that was in 1999, resented by the EU. It was not an hour of glory. It was a feeling of shame. Again, we were not able to do anything. The others had to be NATO, had to do the dirty job. So, 1 week after, basically, yes, 1 week after the war in Kosovo stopped, the EU decided to upgrade its toolbox with a common security and defense policy, a common defense policy which was seen as the operational arm of the common foreign and security policy, the possibility to provide the Union with operational capacity, meaning the possibility to send troops to a theater, to troops for peacekeeping, conflict prevention, strengthening security in accordance with the principles of the United Nations. So, in fact, to intervene, not only militarily, but also, and that was later defined at the Helsinki and at Santa Maria de Feira in 2000, where the concept of civilian crisis management was fleshed out. This is where then where the Union acquired the capacity to send common CSDP missions, mission of the common security and defense policy, to other parts of the world. So not only to talk, but also to act for crisis management, for peacekeeping, for peacemaking. Now, this instrument, the EU has used it quite abundantly. I think we have so far 34 past and ongoing missions underway. And maybe in order, well, I think we should have, to understand what this is all about, we should have a look at the map of the ongoing missions, how they work. Now, looking at this map, looking at the sheer numbers, doesn't tell us much. It tells us something. For example, we have, for the time being, 6 ongoing military missions, the ones in green, then 11 ongoing civilian missions, the one in blue, with a strong geographical concentration in Africa and in the eastern southeastern part, well, neighborhood, and also Western Balkans. These 16 ongoing missions account for about 5,000 EU personnel. So these are EU soldiers, EU policemen, EU judges, public prosecutors deployed in these different countries. Now, is this a lot, 5,000 across 16 missions? Also knowing that 4,000 out of these 11,000 are deployed in the 6 military missions. And that means 1,000 in the 11, less than 1,000 in the 11 civilian mission. So, and also the, if you look at the, compare these different missions, their level of ambition differs widely. For some, in their best time accounted for 7,000 soldiers. The one in Bosnia, Althea, in their best days, 7,000. The smallest one in the border mission in Rafah, in the Gaza Strip, in the best days, that was less than 10 people. So it's really difficult to compare them, because they differ so widely in their level of ambition and impact. We could maybe just make a quick stroll around the map and see the different ones that are still in place, starting by E1 in Bosnia, the oldest one in Bosnia, Althea, the military mission still counting now these days 600 soldiers. The question is it a good employ of EU's resources to have 600 soldiers stationed in a country that is at peace for more than 20 years? Some might contest it, but others say no, this is important for them to be there to keep an eye on the situation, to prevent escalation, to train the local military, to be a moderating force. Well, the jury is still out. Then probably the best military mission, youth UNAFOR in Atalanta since 2008. This is about 1,200 EU military staff being deployed in the Indian Ocean on military vessels with a mandate to fight piracy. And here we can see how CSDP is employed as a strategic instrument for defending the strategic interests of the Union, because a decade ago, piracy in the Indian Ocean was threatening to disrupt one of the main trading routes for the EU, and the EU as a main trading bloc in the world, for it was quite a high stake. So 1,200 marines on EU vessels with EU flags in the Indian Ocean with a mandate to catch pirates. Now, it quickly turned out that catching the pirates was the easy part of the job. The most difficult part of the job was to decide what to do with the pirates afterwards, especially if you're committed to the rule of law and human rights, as the EU are, as a EU military mission is. Well, then, there is another naval mission, Irini, making sure that the arms embargo against Libya is respected in the Mediterranean Sea, plus a couple of smaller military training missions in the Sahel zone and in Somalia with a mandate to train local military to increase their capacity in order to help them to fight Boko Haram and the like. Now, these go often hand in hand with civilian training missions, civilian CSDP mission, police training missions, where then police train the where European police is training the police forces or the gendarmerie of these countries. Now, on the civilian side, here maybe I go to the next map, which gives a better picture, because it not only shows the missions, where the missions are, but also the number of people deployed. We realize that the biggest civilian mission is still Kosovo, ULEX Kosovo, rule of law mission. In their best days, 2,000 European police, judges, public prosecutors, and customs officials. Now it's still about 400. And so now ULEX is a very amazing thing. And the most amazing thing is that the EU was able to agree on setting up this mission in Kosovo. Why? Because for the EU, Kosovo officially still doesn't exist as a country. Now, when Kosovo declared its unilaterally declared its independence in 2008, 23 member states recognized it as a state, 5 member states did not recognize it, meaning that the EU as a whole did not recognize it either. Still, the EU managed to deploy and to agree with the Kosovo government to send 2,000 police, judges, public prosecutors, and customs officials to this region in order, to this region slash country, in order to help them to build the rule of law, to mentor, monitor, and advise their Kosovo counterparts. And even more than that, they have an executive mandate. Executive mandate, meaning if you're in Kosovo and commit a crime, you can be arrested by a French policeman, being charged by a Portuguese prosecutor, and being judged by a German judge, because it's an executive mission and the Kosovans themselves, they're happy with this arrangement. So don't ask me now how they made it in particular. I could tell it to you, because that's my specialty since after 4 years in Kosovo, but it will take a long time, longer than this course lasts. But here it shows clearly that the EU can be creative if it is working around a problem, if it wants to work around a problem, and if there is enough political will to do so. Now, after Kosovo, quite a substantial presence in Ukraine, an EU advisory mission which advises their Ukrainian counterparts on how to build the rule of law, how to fight corruption. That's more straightforward here. plus a border mission in Georgia, where EU, the EU checks or controls the administrative borderline with the breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia in order to prevent any escalation here. And a very small symbolic training mission, police training mission in Iraq and in the Palestine territories. The border control mission in Rafah in the Gaza Strip, I have mentioned it, in their best days there were 16 EU officials in their best days, because it has been set up in 2005 and has been put on ice in 2006 when Hamas came to power, and since then it's dormant. Nothing has happened since 2006. Nobody's on the ground, but it's still on the list. And yes, then the one in Niger, police training mission in Libya, Niger. So this is the situation as it stands now. So you see very different levels of engagement, of ambition. Now, questions, what does it take to deploy such a mission? Who decides? Well, it takes two things. It takes, first of all, the political will from the European Union, which is shared by all the member states. So all the member states have to agree. It's unanimity, CSDP. Second, it takes the agreement of the partner country, the country these forces are deployed to, because, yes, the EU doesn't want to be seen as an occupying power that imposes itself. It has to be with the agreement of that country. And then the capacities. Someone has to be able to deploy, to second their staff to these countries, because, you know, the EU, like NATO, has no own military, no own troops. They rely on the troops that are put at its disposal by the member states. Same thing for police, same thing for judges and prosecutors. So, and, well, this seems to be quite a big problem, especially for the more, let's say, scary parts like the Sahel zone. Not many member states are pretty keen to send send their staff to these places. At some point in the past, we've seen quite a lot of military CSDP missions in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Why? Because that was easy to agree upon. Nobody was against it. And then, we had one member state who was quite keen of sending their troops to that particular country. And guess which language was the most widely spoken among these troops. Interesting also to which extent the different member states contribute to the CSDP mission. And here I've shown you the breakdown of the staffing of the CSDP mission according to nationality. We see that for the civilian mission, the biggest sending country is France. For the military ones, the biggest outsending country is Spain, which sends 300 troops, military, to CSDP mission, followed by Germany and Italy. Number four is Portugal. Portugal has 62 soldiers in sub-Saharan Africa CSDP mission. For the civilian mission, France is the first one, followed by Italy, Germany, and Portugal. Where's Portugal? Portugal is somewhere here with six staff. So six, whatever it might be, police, or probably police, or gendarmerie, or judges in civilian missions deployed. Question is, of course, why in sub-Saharan Africa and the Sahel zone, where's France? France is relatively far down the list. Only 53 troops. Yes, but do not forget that France has its own troops there. Under the French flag, they do it without the EU. So this is in the CSDP mission. In addition to what countries might do bilaterally, this is also in addition to what might be done through the UN. So through UN troops. So far about the CSDP mission. Now, again, I go back to the agenda, and in the agenda of the Portuguese presidency, and in principle, I can only repeat, I'm afraid, what I already said in the previous presentation, that the agenda here is largely events-driven. This is, CSDP is reactive. We react to events that happen that happen elsewhere. And yes, and then in addition, we need unanimity. We need an agreement of the partner country, and we need a sufficient number of troops to be deployed. So there are quite a few items that might pop on our agenda. Nagorno-Karabakh is likely to be there. Belarus, Russia is becoming more and more a destabilizing factor, not only in the neighborhood, but also in other parts of the world. Then, okay, we have, of course, Libya, Syria, Iran, and others. Unless there is something, another theater which is coming up, an hotspot which are not there on our list, is there any potential on these, for example, for sending up a CSDP mission? I doubt. Now, in the Sahel, we have already a few. Libya, I doubt, because as we see, the member states are not at all on the same wavelength when it comes to whom to support and whom not to support. Then in a country like Belarus or Syria, don't even think about this, because you will never get the agreement of the host country. And also, I think few Europeans would consider sending European troops to Syria. Nagorno-Karabakh, interesting. It might be very difficult, also due to the presence of Russia. But in the end, if that can be a face-saving solution for both sides to stop the fighting, and also that could be a possibility on bringing Turkey on board, because the fine thing about a CSDP mission is they're not limited to EU member states. The EU has agreements with quite a number of third countries to participate in CSDP mission. So we have some Canadians, some Norwegians, some Icelanders, but we also had in the past Turkish policemen serving, for example, in Kosovo for ULEX with a cooperation agreement with the EU. So that would be quite an interesting way of, buying in other countries. Again, whether this might fly or not is highly doubtful, but it's maybe worth thinking of. So, I stop here for a moment to see whether there are any reactions, questions. If not, I still have a bit of a case study in bonus for you. To cover time, if you want, I can also still say a few words about the D in CSDP, which is about defense cooperation, which is quite different from what we've seen here. It is about going towards a European defense, and this is something where we saw huge progress since 2016. You wouldn't say so, because now we had the impression that over the last decade the focus was more on preventing the EU from imploding or falling apart. But there's one area where we made huge progress towards integration over the last 4 years, and this is the defense area of defense. And wonder why that is so. Anyway, I would stop here to listen to any questions or comments.
Yes, perhaps if we do a small pause here. I would just say that I agree completely in terms of the agenda of the Portuguese presidency. The parliamentary dimension side plays by a different set of rules. And I would also comment that some of these issues have a tendency to become permanent. I remember a recent comment in one of the meetings that I was in that we were talking about issues in the Mediterranean, and I think it was a representative from Cyprus that said, right, we've been dealing this with these issues that have been plagued the region for some time on a reactive basis, but in truth, these are becoming now permanent issues of the region that need a long-term strategy, and that's why the Mediterranean Group tries to bring Mediterranean issues front and center on the EU decision-making progress. However, I do have a message from Bruno, who wishes to speak on this issue. So, Bruno, please, go ahead.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah?
We can hear.
Okay. Sorry, because in the morning I had a bit of an issue. Hi, I'm Bruno. I'm the Brussels-based representative of the Parliament. And I would like to thank you very much for this very comprehensive presentation that you gave, which sparked some questions on my side. And I will go directly and as bluntly as possible to all of them. First of all, where do you see national parliaments and the European Parliament stepping in all of this? Meaning, how do you see the role of interparliamentary cooperation in all this constellation that you so brilliantly described? And going a little bit deeper, do you believe there's some added value in what parliaments like to call parliamentary diplomacy? Because, I mean, this is quite an intense activity. We have CFSP and CSDP Interparliamentary Conference. You have the meetings of the AFET Committee of the EPU with National Parliament. Then you have a plethora of parliamentary assemblies for virtually every region. So how do you see this sub-constellation fitting in the constellation that you described? Then on the topics, I think you are right in saying that there's always a high degree of unforeseen events, Libya, Syria, now Nagorno-Karabakh, but I think there are some topics that are gaining a sort of permanent character. For instance, China. China used to be a summit that would take place every year. Now it's an issue every week. So how do you see also this trend? And I heard you say that you would go into the defense areas, which is something very relevant for our presidency as well. And as we are preparing the agenda for the CFSP-CSDP conference, I would like to hear your thoughts on which topics would you deem more appropriate: European defense identity, the strategic compass, PESCO, etc. Thank you very much in advance.
Yes, thank you, Rina. I will try to answer this. Well, for the national parliaments, I think the IPC is a very important forum already for an exchange of ideas, and also for sparking new debates and for giving input to shaping the agenda, as are the contacts with the European Parliament. Now, I mean, we all know that when it comes to CFSP proprement dit, the parliaments, the European Parliament and also the parliaments are not really at the table. And for the national parliaments, of course, then this depends on the own constitutional arrangements. I mean, in some countries, nothing works without the national parliaments. So through this track, there is quite a bit, I think, some scope for shaping the debate. As regards for China, well, China, I think, is not so much a CFSP, a CSDP issue, but more there are other agendas, for example, the trade agenda, trade policy, and here you are right, this has become a bit of a permanent issue. Also, I mean, these days, we in the EU, we are talking about China when we're not talking about China, in the sense that very often China is the elephant in the room. For example, when you ask yourself, why are we investing so much political capital on, for example, having an investment protection in the agreements, in our free trade agreements with other countries like the US or Canada or Australia? Do we really think that we need this with the US or Canada and Australia? And most people would say no, and we don't need it with Australia, or we don't need it with Canada, with the we don't need it with the US. But however, we want to make sure that it becomes also a gold standard, as long as we are still in the position of setting standards, of shaping the agenda. Now, in a few years from now, in a decade from now, that might no longer be the case, seeing the surge of China in international trade. So, right, China is there, even if we're not talking about China. Then, for the defense, yes, I think the what is important is now to keep the what has been kicked off, to keep this on track and make sure that it doesn't end up on the back burner. I mean, it was a window of opportunity, and I mean, I think it's clear. I mean, when I said, okay, guess why, since 2016 we've certainly had a new surge of activities in the area. It was because of Brexit. It was because of the foot was off the brake. The country that was always standing in the way was silly gone, and we jumped in and created all these new activities, the coordinated review, the defense action plan. We set up the commission proposing European defense funds, and which a few years before would have been absolutely non-imaginable European headquarters. So I think now also, we became serious on PESCO. So I think the focus is now not to come up with new initiatives, but to keep these old initiatives on track, to make sure that they are filled with life, also to strengthen the partnership with NATO, which is not always easy, but which should maybe be easier after the next elections in the US. So I hope I answered all your questions to the extent which I was able to do.
I suggest we move on. We don't have a lot more time. If you could conclude your presentation, then we'll have just a couple more minutes for Q&A.
Okay. So, yes, I said I had a few bonus slides, and that is a case study. It is about the role of the European Parliament in CFSP. And you remember that in the beginning I said, okay, European Parliament, CFSP, CSDP, that doesn't go together, because if you remember article, 36 of the treaty, which clearly says, Parliament, you stay out, right? We keep you at arm's length. Now, it would be easy to conclude, okay, Parliament, we don't have to take this into account. And I have to say, this is generally, my feeling is that this is pretty much the prevailing mood in the Council, to say, okay, we don't have to worry about the Parliament, we just do our thing. However, there are some ways in which the European Parliament can make its voice heard and make sure that it is taken into account. And here I give you a very nice case study, which goes, where comes back to case I presented about OINAF for Atalanta, the anti-piracy mission in the Indian Ocean. You remember that one? Vessels catching pirates in the Indian Ocean. And here, I think I told you that the difficulty for OINAF for Atalanta was not so much catching pirates, easy part. The most difficult part was what to do with them afterwards. And then what they did in the first year, they transferred the pirates to the EU, to places like the Netherlands, Sweden, to be indicted by a Swedish or Dutch prosecutor, to be judged by a French or Danish judge, and to serve their prison sentence in a Finnish prison in the end. Now, very quickly, the member states came to the conclusion then this was not maybe the most
effective and efficient way of doing this, also because it didn't really have a deterrent, it didn't really deter piracy in this part of the world, if you know what I mean. So the EU came then up with an idea saying, why don't we sign agreements with other countries in the region and ask them to take our pirates. For example, the EU signed an agreement with Mauritius and saying that, okay, you agreed to take our pirates and you will put them to justice and let them serve a prison sentence there by respecting our conditions, meaning rule of law must be respected, human rights, and in exchange for this, we give you generous financial assistance. Win-win situation, would say, right? Yeah. So this is why in 2014 the EU signed a similar agreement with Tanzania. Now, you see here the former High Representative, Ms. Ashton, signing this agreement with the Tanzanian counterpart. And this agreement was an agreement under the Common Foreign and Security Policy, a CFSP agreement, because for the Council it was clear that's Common Foreign and Security Policy. The treaty normally says that for any international agreement you have to first of all, consult the parliament, and then the parliament has to give its consent, meaning to approve the agreement. With one exception is if the agreement is is exclusively or principally about CFSP. So if it's about foreign and security policy, in this case, the parliament is out. This is what the council did. The parliament somehow begged to differ. They did not agree. They said, listen, council, what you are doing here, proposing, is cooperation in the field of police and criminal justice. And this is a different legal basis. And if we have an agreement in the field of criminal justice and of police cooperation, then another article applies, and you have to consult us, and you have to ask us to give consent. The council said, nope, we disagree, this is CFSP, you have no role here, stay out. Now, then the European Parliament took the council to justice, to the Court of Justice. What do you think the Court of Justice said? Well, the Court of Justice partly sided with the Parliament, partly sided with the Council. For the question of the legal basis, whether the Council chose the legal basis, meaning CFSP instead of police and justice cooperation, the Council said, well, it is not exclusively about CFSP, but it is predominantly about CFSP, so that is okay. However, what is not okay is that the Council didn't consult the Parliament. Here in the slides you have the relative parts of the, for later lecture, you have the relative parts of the ruling. So, basically, because the Council didn't consult the Parliament, the Court of Justice annulled the agreement. Imagine, it signed an anti-piracy agreement with Tanzania, and then the Court of Justice tells the Council, oops, we have to annul it, it's no longer valid. It was a quite embarrassing exercise for the council. They had to go back and explain to the Tanzanians that their argument is no longer valid. At least the Court of Justice took care in precising that the effects of this decision are maintained into force, meaning that the pirates which had already been transferred to Tanzania under this agreement, they could stay where they were. They didn't have to be taken back. So, you see, still there is, in this case, the Parliament found a breach to put the foot in the door of CSP, but this is basically the only way the Parliament can put a foot in the door, since this is based on Article 40, of the treaty, which says that the European Court of Justice is competent to decide on the legality of a legal basis. So here the question was the legal basis well chosen, CFSP instead of police cooperation, and the Court of Justice said no. So this is why how the Parliament managed to get the foot in the door and to assert itself here. That was my little case study. Again, if there are any questions, comments, I'd be happy to hear.
Thank you, Wolfgang. Before moving back to Q&A, I'll just add a few notes on the conference side of things from the parliamentary dimensions perspective. This is a bit related to what I already mentioned, but as some of you may know, there has always been informal exchanges of information between some of the southern European parliaments in anticipation of the CFSP-CSDP conference. We share common interests, and this was an attempt, an ongoing opportunity to exchange information and see where everyone stood on the issues being discussed at the conference. Over time, a group of these countries that we now aptly call Group Med began to hold regular meetings. From 2014 onwards, the list of countries belonging to this group was fixed at 7 parliaments from Mediterranean countries, namely Portugal, Spain, France, Italy, Malta, Cyprus, and Greece. The Portuguese Parliament has always been a strong backer of this group. In fact, we recently suggested expanding the meeting format to include panelists on issues relevant to the Mediterranean region, and perhaps we might even try to this new format during our presidency, Teresa, perhaps? Okay, so why is this relevant? Obviously, we are talking opinions here, my opinion, but it seems that the CFSP conference crossed some sort of Rubicon quite a few years ago. Regarding the preparation of conclusions. Participants now expect them. So this has been a change that's been happening gradually over time. And I single out the presidency here because even the European Parliament, who co-hosts the conference, is always in favor of adopting conclusions. Now, our German friends were able to get away with a declaration in the last conference, but this was mostly because of the COVID restrictions that were in place. Since we are strong backers of the group Med, of this group, and taking into consideration that there might be little to no room about not promoting conclusions, we might be in a position where we have to juggle the interests of our group Med friends, of our responsibilities before the Troika and before the other delegations participating on this issue regarding the conclusions. This means a lot of the negotiation, but I think the associated risk can be mitigated if we do our due diligence selecting the topics, speakers, and preparing our committee chairmen for the next few months. So this is why you're presentation was very important, and I thank you for it. And I don't know if Bruno wants to say one more word on this, or otherwise I can give the floor to our military liaison, Admiral Noronha Bragança. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, João. And because we are talking about foreigner policy and defense, I would like to start to thanks to all the service of our Parliament colleagues that organized this seminar, namely the two moderators, Maria Teresa and João, and also, don't forget, Bruno in Brussels, that allowed us, the other colleagues probably, to reduce a little bit the level of anxiety and prepare for the important growth level of excitement in the next semester. I would like also thanks to European Institute, and Andrew, and Wolfgang, thank you. Also, don't forget Petra, Diana, Igor, and also Noria, and sorry, Noria, if I don't spell it correctly. Wolfgang, you are listening? Yeah? Okay. Now, directly for a comment, joining agenda for me, and in the perspective that I've been already in a Portuguese presidency, it's really important, this cooperation between the Troika, and because one of the issues for me is the, I don't know how is at this moment, and probably Wolfgang can elaborate a little bit more about this, is the long decision process in EU. It's really important. We understand that there are a lot of actors involved in this process, but this for me something that points out the idiosyncratic way of European Union that make the difference between and I speak in my first part in the presence. I was on the field, so I understood this importance of this cooperation, interinstitutional cooperation inside the EU, but also the multi-institutional cooperation. Talking about this, it was very interesting to see you, Wolfgang, speak about Atalanta, because we'll have the lead of at sea of Atalanta next year, in the next semester. But we have the government and taking care that the Parliament is involved, as we all already understood the level of involvement of our Parliament. But the government also already decides four main objectives. This is like the ATM. We have only four numbers because it's easier to understand it, to fix. So EU, Africa, it will be one of the subjects for sure. The other one, EU-NATO relationship, how we can reinforce coherence, interoperability. The other one what will be maritime security in the Atlantic, in the Gulf of Guinea. And probably we can speak a little bit about the Center for the Atlantic that Portugal is in partnership with member states and the other partners ready to launch in the next year. And finally, to reinforce or to give more identity to this defense, to get to the European defense identity. That will be four main topics. And of course, we need to have the needed flexibility to be aware what could going on or what can happen during this presidency. However, we always have this long decision process that could spend more than 6 months. So, once again, thank you very much for all the presentations. But for me, in particular, thank you very much, Wolfgang, for this. Your intervention, your clear presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I would also ask Patricia. She's an advisor to the National Defense Committee.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for your presentation. To take off the mask. I don't have that much of an experience with the CEFSP and TSPD interparliamentary conferences. What I have a long experience with, and this is a question more about opinions than facts, is what Bruno talked about, the other branch of parliamentary diplomacy that is connected with the parliamentary assemblies. And in that situation, a long time ago, in my first years in parliament, I had a moment in which important, relevant members of a delegation decided not to attend a meeting because a meeting, the speakers were mainly high-ranked civil servants or scholars. So now, flash forward to my first CSPD Interparliamentary Conference, and what are the speakers in that conference? Scholars from local or European think tanks. So my question is, do you think that the interaction of good practices and know-how between parliaments or even between national parliaments and the European Parliament can be somehow harmed or diminished by the fact that they are not having a politician-to-politician debate, but a scholar-to-politician, I wouldn't even call it a debate. It's more like an explanation. There are no ministers, former ministers. Even high-ranked officials are in very few number. So what do you think this means for the importance and especially for the outcome of these conferences? Thank you.
Well, thank you for this question. It made me smile a little bit because that reminded me that 25 years ago I started my career as an assistant to the member of the European Parliament. So I know a bit, had a bit of a feeling also about the dynamics in the Parliament and how MEPs tick. And I know that for many they are of the opinion, okay, we are politicians and we want to speak with other politicians. We don't want to speak to civil servants. We don't want to be lectured by a lecturer. That's beyond us. That's one element. But the other one is that also I think politicians sometimes need some, let's say, fresh views and input. And it should be a balance. And I mean, otherwise they will be you might say, steaming in their own juice a lot. So I would then, I know from my own experience that it's very difficult to give advice to MPs, to MEPs, but on the other hand, I know that sometimes they deliberately opt for this format. For example, I've been to a couple of summer universities organized by political parties where I was also invited as an external expert. And then I saw quite some animated debates also between scholars and politicians. So meaning if it's in the right format, they might enjoy this. It brings them something, knowing that, okay, if politicians, MPs are next to other MPs, they are unlikely to admit that they don't, that there are things that they do, that they do not know, or like asking questions or so. That's a bit tricky, but in the right settings, I mean, you can have good debates. So I would say it needs the right mixture. So politicians, of course, they need to speak to their peers from other parliaments, change ideas, but also to get external input.
Thank you, Wolfgang. I'll call Teresa to the table for the final conclusions. And yes, she will join us now. And Edward. Thank you, Wolfgang. Thank you so much.
So, thank you, Wolfgang. With which we, the team here, Maastricht, Paris, Luxembourg, from APA, are going to round off our contributions. And before passing to you to close the event, which is your place, just a few concluding remarks. Not conclusions. We're not going to reach any judgments about it, but just a few remarks. I think we have also found it an interesting discussion. Hope you have. And we very much hope that sessions have contributed to the preparations for the parliamentary dimension, maybe three levels. Yeah. The agenda of the meetings, we've just been talking about it. And we're literally been talking about the agendas, in fact, as well, and the formats, as well as substantive issues. So hopefully in economic governance, CFSP, CSDP, some elements will have come up which will contribute to your endeavours. A second level, I guess, is the EU agenda, in priority issues which may or may not have a specific format of interparliamentary cooperation, whether it's the Green Deal, the social pillar, digital transition, or migration. Priority issues for everybody, especially the presidency, and maybe perhaps also the agenda items that have come up will be of relevance. And thirdly, if I may sort of now pull back to the beginning of the 2 days, which in a sense we've gone round a cycle, the general agenda of the EU and its democratic governance and the role of national parliaments in that system of democratic governance. You are going to have an interesting time. I think all presidencies will say that to themselves just before, but I can see so many objective things that are going to hit you, for better or worse. We have the crisis. Who knows? Maybe the beginning of the end of the crisis, or the end of the beginning of the crisis. I don't know. We also have the culmination of varying pressures to reform things and rethink things. It seems to be rather a mode to come up with three-word slogans for things: recovery, reform, and resilience. And I think we also had a discussion at the end of the morning on the first day about the need to take care. This has been a sensitive period. Images of the EU, its ability to respond, its notions of solidarity, its way that people participate. We've had a hit. And it's a matter of repairing not only the damage to the internal market, but also its institutions and its system of governance. However, I think we also variously made comments to the effect that we need to be prudent and avoid creating false expectations or false blames. And I think that is a challenge in which national parliaments have a fundamental role, which is getting beyond that and trying to promote public understanding and acceptance of this new realities. Because these simple dichotomies of naming and blaming and so on are not going to help. We covered certain sectors in which it's quite clear that the relationship between EU and national actors is not simple anymore. Whether you think it ought to be more one or the other, it's not even that. It's gone beyond that in ways which are very hard to understand and explain and are clearly and rightly sensitive. We talked about the role of budgets in this House and how a national parliament is now part of a different kind of context, which is very hard for people to understand. So first thought, the resilience facility is a key moment, I think, and a turning point. Mrs. von der Leyen was here this week talking about in Portugal, and I know that you told me that Portugal has a clear commitment to being a leading figure in demonstrating how this can work. Well, I'm going to be following with great interest how that works. Because, yes, I think we agree. It was a historic moment towards, shall we call it, integration, deeper integration with more solidarity. The collective borrowing, the grants, this is new. But you read the document, read the small print about how this is going to work. And I think we started to put it in the new context. Diane also pointed to this. This is part, it's going to be linked in new ways, not only to grants, but also to conditions. And there is a strong trend coming out of all this process of political debate and disagreement towards more linkages, leverages, conditionalities. It'll be concerns sound economic governance. The European semester is not dead. It's going to concern rule of law. And I think we're seeing also now linking to the migration debate we had, how differences and sensitivities are going to make it quite hard to move ahead there. Second level, we mentioned the budgetary question. It's not going to come your way, so to speak, because it's the second half of the year. But even so, this is a new role and a new concept. And as we come out of the crisis, hopefully, as we go into the conference, probably, I think it's important to get these notions on the table in ways that go beyond, excuse me, the transnational list in the EP, which is not the solution to all these issues about the roles of national elected actors. The point was made by, I think, Diane, that one of the issues facing the European semester is the lack of national ownership. And that was a word that came up way back with Mr. Barroso, in fact, the problem of ownership. I'm not sure that's the right word, to be honest. I think it's much more an intertwining interaction. and a sense of shared responsibility, which is very hard to pin down and to explain. Third, we came up with EGOT on the first afternoon. We hit the social pillar, which I think many people have seen with hope, that this, together with the Green Deal, will make us green, the digital transition will make us digital, the social pillar will. Well, if you look carefully at it, as we try to do, looking at the competencies, the money, the fund, the reality is that most of this is still national business. And some would argue it should be. There's a long-standing academic argument that there is an inherent limit to what is legitimate in terms of European social policy. And it brings us back to national parliaments and the role of protection. Social protection. We talk about it, as Igor showed, half of the social pillar is about social protection. Whereas the reality is that most citizens look for social protection where? Exactly. There is a tension and some gaps here, which will not be easy to overcome. Now, I want to be positive, and I am, individually and for what it matters, but I would only hope that all actors take it with a sense of responsibility for placing this in the right terms and perspective so that people don't get misled. Because there's nothing worse than expectations dashed when you're unemployed and you thought you were going to... It's not going to help to promise things that aren't going to be realistically forthcoming, certainly not from the EU level. So, yes, coming back and concluding before passing over, national parliaments, I think, are, of course, most directly concerned. And they have been, I think, challenged in many of the traditional roles and powers. And I guess that's why we went through the phase of talking about subsidiarity control, the early warning system. It's a phrase I don't like. All with a very negative tone of how to stop things happening. And I followed with interest, as an outsider, how national parliaments have moved towards, or tried to move towards, this more positive engagement and imagery, the green card and all that. The national parliaments are not a defence mechanism. They're a creative and constructive part of this new emerging system. And I think, great, that's the way to go. Everybody at their levels interacting, doing better and explaining better. Thinking back to the great disaster of 2005 when the Constitution went into a dustbin, let's avoid that kind of thing and think about, and I go back to my themes for democratic governance, and I conclude there, how to involve MPs, how to interest them in all this and make it clear this is not something up there in Brussels that you don't have to care about. I was very interested in hearing Bruno's comments about how he feeds this from that end of things. And I think, great, this is certainly an important dynamic in individual interest, but also linking it to national debates, other kinds of actors, other kinds of dynamic, and events in the two levels. And beyond that, how to engage citizens in participation in ways which are linked and mutually reinforcing with representative democracy. That's a big gap which we have to improve. And I do think that more than transnationalist multi-level parties is the thing. It's not even a matter of parliaments only. It's a matter of the party system and the broader system of engagement and debate which is missing. And finally, I look forward to following, you know, how the interparliamentary cooperation mechanisms may contribute to new forms of transnational association. Not transnational lists up there, but transnational horizontally, between parliaments, between societies. Because I have a feeling that that can be an essential element of building more solid and solidary integration in the long run. So, I will be following that. I think we've had the possibility this afternoon to look at the external dimension and try to link the different levels and actors. Events will indeed probably be definitive in many respects there. With which, my few words of rounding things off come to an end, and if I may, before turning to you, just thank you very much again for having invited us to join with you in participating in such a... It was a challenging event, but I hope you are pleased with how it's turned out. I think we've all been very interested in the discussions. Thank you very much, and all the very success for the parliamentary dimension. Thank you, Maria Teresa.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Everybody wants to go home or to finish some work. I would just like to stress that this yesterday and today seminar was a little bit a complement of what we did early this year in January. A huge group of colleagues, we went to Brussels, to the EU institutions, so we had the chance to have the briefings from our colleagues in the European Parliament, in our permanent representation, in the European Commission. So we heard a lot of experts, you know, the practitioners, on several topics, some the same that we have treating these 2 days. And now we've heard like more an academic view on the on these topics. So I would say in my head that there's a sentence all the time, which is food for thoughts. So I think we have food enough for thoughts, and now it's up to us. We take it from here, so we have the materials that you shared with us, and our colleagues in Brussels also shared with us. So I think from now we are, we have everything we need to make some good proposals for our MPs and chairpersons and president, then to decide over the agenda. So we, I think I can speak on us all. Thank you for all of your efforts and preparations to deliver what we asked you to. And I leave it a promise that in the end of our presidency, I will make a collection of our agendas and forward it to you, and then you may see whether they have a correspondence with all your advices. I think they will have some correspondence, but I think it will be an interesting exercise to do. So regarding our parliamentary dimension, we will start in January with a conference of COSAC chairpersons. Then we will have a meeting on Europol scrutiny, let's say it that way. Then, of course, we have the conference on economic governance, better say European semester. We will also have the conference on the CFSP, CSDP. And then we'll have a COSAC, the well-known conference on among the chairpersons of the European Affairs Committees all over Europe that join, as you know, the 27 member states plus the European Parliament, which mean 39 parliamentary chambers, so it's a lot of parliamentarians. And then we will also have a high-level conference on migration, and we are thinking of doing also something regarding relationship between European Union and Africa. So a lot of work in ahead of us. Just to end up, I would, well, and of course all these topics will be certainly on the agenda, and then we will certainly have our own Nagorno-Karabakh, because there's always something, some Belarus, there's always something unexpected that we will have to insert. And last time, we will be prepared, mentally prepared for that. And now I just wanted to thank again EIPA and Edward, of course, with your leadership, Nora helping us back home, and all the colleagues that were with us and as a speaker. I would also like to remind that a Secretary General of the Parliament was also Director General of EIPA, Ms. Isabel Corte-Real. So this is an interesting coincidence. And now I would like to thank my colleagues, because this is a team work. So the colleagues that thought with me all the contents of this program. I would like to thank Cristina Correia, the head of division of the committees, Bruno Pinheiro, our representative in Brussels, and then, of course, the colleagues from the committees, because this was pretty much made for them, who participated here and online and also made some questions. So thanks to them. My colleagues from the Training and Human Resources Department, because this was also a joint venture with them, especially Laura Costa and Marta Coutinho, and our colleagues from the IT Department. They were very patient with our demands and very flexible. So I thank also Diogo, Paulo and José, and our colleagues from the sound, so Cristiano and Vasco. I'm sorry if I forgot some of you. And of course our colleagues from the protocol as well. So Susana and Paulo, I thank you all. I would also thank our Secretary General because he's the one who let us do all these things and support us. So it's important when you have all the colleagues in the same boat. It is a really it is really helpful and a good ingredient for success. So again, I close with this wording: food for thought. Now we will think about it and we will write a lot of papers, I'm sure. Thank you very much and enjoy your weekend. Bye bye.
So again, thank you, Nora. I'll call you late. Have a nice evening. I'll talk to you. Bye.